They channel power and signals that make equipment hum and engines run, from oil rigs and broadcast studios to cars and trains, commercial buildings, and factory floors. Cables keep information flowing, facilitating a non-stop stream of words and images that transcend speed and geographical limits.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear colleague and friend who has prepared an interesting feature program for you all. Let's go check it out.
One of the amazing outcomes of the IT sector is that we no longer need to stand in long queues to get our daily affairs done, such as financial transactions or even getting a cab. But that amazing feature has not come about on its own. It's thanks to dedicated companies like ITSaaS that we enjoy the growing benefits of the IT sector. Launched in 2016, the fledgling Iranian brand offers a range of online services. Governments are increasingly shifting from physical to e-services to facilitate administrative procedures for their citizens. ITSaaS has put this issue on top of its agenda and has pushed the envelope on e-government services. The Iranian brand has tasked itself to be entirely independent of foreign technologies. ITSaaS says its products and services are developed from A to Z by Iranian experts. The zeros and ones are permeating every aspect of our lives, and the Iranian IT company says it seeks to build smart cities in Iran with the goal of building a smarter life with AI. With its 200 dedicated experts, ITSaaS thinks big. It seeks to export its services to other countries to both find a foothold in the global market and promote e-services in the world. As it says, aside from making our lives easier, a smarter world translates into a greener environment.
For our final segment of the program, let's take a look at some news and developments in the realm of healthcare. From printing hip replacements to even hearts, there is so much more to discover with 3D technologies. Now, a group of Iranian scientists has built a three-dimensional scanner that can scan the entire body in less than 1 minute.
In seconds, the scanner collects information from millions of body parts by using infrared radiation. It then measures different physical parameters, such as height or weight, to provide other information. The scanner captures the position of the body in reality and registers data in virtual reality through light or laser beam. This technology is a precise way to monitor body changes.
The Iranian government has been stepping up its support for knowledge-based productions, and this year, the number of loans paid to knowledge-based firms has sharply risen.
Loans paid by banks were up by nearly 130% in the first 10 months of this year compared to the year before. The domestic banking system paid nearly $2 billion of facilities to 1,200 knowledge-based companies. That's based on figures from Iran's central bank. The government developed schemes to bolster their efforts in productions. Productions in these companies have already reduced several bottlenecks in various industries.
An Iranian knowledge-based company has produced insulin pens, which have been released into the market after months of sanctions-driven shortages.
The developer says they have commercialized the device, which is a long-acting insulin pen that patients inject every 24 hours. Currently, 1 million of these products received approval from the Ministry of Health and can be found in pharmacies across the country. The shortage in recent months created problems for scores of patients struggling to maintain their diabetes. Experts say U.S. sanctions have spurred a boom in the domestic manufacturing sector. This is while the government is diversifying the economy away from oil revenues.
That covers our program for today. Thank you for tuning in. I will see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new statistical report on the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza shows the unbearable price paid by Palestinians for the maintenance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Maureen Claire Murphy, writer. This article is published under the heading Gaza Pays the Price for Jewish State in Palestine. This is the first part of this article. A new statistical report on the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza shows the unbearable price paid by Palestinians for the maintenance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Authored by three Palestinian human rights organizations, including Al-Mizan, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and Al-Haq, the report examines the full-scale military offensive endured by Gazans for 11 days in May last year. The extensive damage that the Zionist regime wrought on Gaza further compounded the long-lasting humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip after 14 years of intensified closure and economic blockade, a form of collective punishment prohibited under international law. The Zionist regime, meanwhile, closed its crossings with Gaza during the May escalation. Two children referred for medical treatment outside the coastal enclave died waiting for access, according to the human rights groups. A rigorous field survey by those groups found that 240 Palestinians were killed by the Zionist regime's occupation forces during the 11-day offensive. Of them, 151 were civilians and 89 belonged to armed groups, though 10 of the latter were not actively participating in hostilities when they were killed. Among the 151 civilians killed, 59 were children, 54 were men, and 38 were women. The vast majority, 111 people, were killed by weapons fired from the Zionist regime fire jets. Nearly half of the total 240 people killed in Gaza during the war and all but one of the women killed were at home at the time of the Zionist regime's strike that ended their lives. One-third of the total 240 people killed were engaged in military action at the time. The human rights groups note the large number of casualties compared to the short duration of the military operation and the overall number of civilians, including children and women, killed. The use of overwhelming force against civilians is a key Israeli regime's military strategy. That strategy, the Zahiye Doctrine, is named for the Beirut suburb heavily bombarded by the Zionist regime in 2006, when it was roundly defeated by Hezbollah. By using indiscriminate and disproportionate force, the Zionist regime aims to restore deterrence and turn the targeted civilian population against the armed resistance, whether it be Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hamas in Gaza. In both places, the Zahiye Doctrine has failed to turn the people against the resistance, which has in both in Lebanon and Gaza increased its capacity and capabilities. During May last year, Palestinian unity across geographic and political divides galvanized in ways not seen in years and inspired renewed global solidarity. The May War began after the Zionist regime's police stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque, while it was filled with worshippers, injuring hundreds. Tensions had been brewing in the city for weeks as the Zionist regime sought and continues to seek to expel Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and hand them over to Jewish settlers. Resistance groups in Gaza fired volleys of rockets towards Al-Quds that night after a warning from the leader of Hamas armed wing over attacks in the city went unheeded by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime began striking northern Gaza, where at least 20 Palestinians, including 9 children, were killed on that first day. The 11-day escalation ended with no decisive Israeli regime defeat against the resistance in Gaza, an automatic victory for the latter in the context of anti-colonial guerrilla warfare. The Zahiye Doctrine hasn't achieved what the Zionist regime intends, though it has inflicted profound harm on targeted civilians. But so long as Palestinians rightly refuse to submit to the removal and replacement with foreign settlers, the Zionist regime as the colonizing power requires a horrendously violent policy like the Zahiye Doctrine. That was admitted by the Haifa University demographer Aaron Sofer, a close advisor to the late Israeli regime Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, ahead of the latter's unilateral withdrawal of settlers from Gaza in 2005 and tightened blockade on the territory 2 years later. Sofer anticipated that Palestinians in Gaza, isolated and closed off, and with little other means of leveraging pressure on the Zionist regime, would rely on firing projectiles to resist what has become a medieval siege. "We will tell the Palestinians that if a single missile is fired over the fence, we will fire 10 in response, and women and children will be killed and houses will be destroyed," Sofer explained. Anticipating the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, Sofer added, "The pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So, if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill. All day, every day." This violence is necessary to guarantee a Jewish Zionist regime with an overwhelming majority of Jews, as Sofer thought. That is the logic underlining the Zionist regime's violence last May, when War Minister Benny Gantz warned that No person, area, or neighborhood in Gaza is immune. And so, 14 families lost three or more members when the Zionist regime bombed their homes.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
North Korea says it launched a missile on Sunday as part of developing a reconnaissance satellite system. The North has not elaborated on the type of rocket used in the test, but authorities in South Korea say it appeared to be a ballistic missile, fired from an area near Pyongyang toward the sea off its east coast. The launch was the eighth this year and the first since the end of January when North Korea fired off a record number of projectiles, including its longest-range ballistic missile since 2017. North Korea has ramped up its missile testing in 2022, announcing plans to bolster its defenses against the United States and evaluating restarting all suspended military activities. North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, had previously stated that his country's weapons development is necessary for self-defense in the face of hostile policies from the United States, including sanctions and joint military drills with South Korea. The North has also vowed to strengthen its nuclear capabilities by building more powerful atomic weapons. The exact size and strength of North Korea's nuclear arsenal are unclear. Some estimates say North Korea could have around 200 nuclear weapons by 2027. Pyongyang is believed to have tested nuclear weapons several times. It has also tested ballistic projectiles capable of reaching the United States. But why does North Korea need this expanding military program?
They learned their lesson, in essence. They learned that the United States can't be trusted, and it is willing to commit just horrific crimes against the Korean people to secure its own interests. And so North Korea doesn't want to end up the same way that Iraq is, the way Palestine is, the way Afghanistan is, because of U.S. involvement, U.S. intervention.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said it was consulting with its allies, South Korea and Japan, about the latest test. The command said in a statement that the U.S. condemns the launch and calls on North Korea to refrain from further, quote, destabilizing acts. Following a series of North Korean missile launches, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions against Pyongyang. Washington has also called on the Security Council to take action against several North Korean individuals and entities accused of violating resolutions that ban North Korea's projectiles and nuclear weapons development. North Korean citizens continue to suffer because of the sanctions. The World Food Program has estimated that 10.1 million North Koreans are suffering from food shortages. Also, the UN has acknowledged that the US-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
The US sanctions against Korea have been devastating. It has significantly hurt the living standard of the people in North Korea. But with that in mind, they have pushed forward. They have continued on despite the difficult situation that they've been dealt because of U.S. foreign policy. You see that in their scientific advancements. You see that in their rebuilding of the nation after the Korean War. And you're seeing that now as they continue since the Trump administration continue to build newer and improve upon previous models of nuclear warheads.
Despite the sanctions, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is pursuing a plan for developing weapons that included hypersonic weapons, spy satellites, solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine-launched nuclear projectiles. Kim has intensified expanding his country's military capabilities since his diplomacy with former United States President Donald Trump ended without an agreement in 2019.
Well, I certainly hope that the U.S. is serious about improving relations, but I highly doubt it. I think perhaps the first thing that could be done is the U.S. removing its forces from South Korea, because you have to recognize that in a lot of ways, the Republic of Korea or South Korea is just a staging ground for U.S. and NATO forces to be right there on the demilitarized border of North Korea. And so if the U.S. is serious about improving relations, it should, in my opinion, completely withdraw from South Korea, all forces.
Trump took unprecedented steps by initiating several rounds of dialogue with the North. However, Washington blew what Pyongyang called a golden opportunity. The United States, Britain, Europe, and Canada moved to block certain Russian banks' access to the SWIFT international payment system as part of more sanctions against Moscow as it continues its military operation against Ukraine.
We are resolved to continue imposing massive costs on Russia, costs that will further isolate Russia from the international financial system and our economies.
The measures, which will also include restrictions on the Russian central bank's international reserves, will be implemented in the coming days.
We will paralyze the assets of Russia's central bank. This will freeze its transactions, and it made it impossible for the central bank to liquidate assets.
Von der Leyen said removing Russia from SWIFT will paralyze Russia's international trade and effectively stop its imports and exports. Earlier, Berlin announced it has agreed to limit Moscow's access to SWIFT as well. The SWIFT system is a Belgian cooperative that offers many services in assisting businesses and individuals to complete seamless and accurate business transactions. Western countries have joined the chorus as well. The U.S. says Western nations will also impose restrictive measures on the Russian central bank to prevent it from deploying its international reserves in ways that undermine the impact of sanctions. But how much damage will these sanctions have on the fragile global economy? The sanctions add to the economic impact of this crisis and will transmit primarily through energy prices as well as grain prices. Russia and Ukraine supply crops to a long list of countries around the world, including large volumes to buyers in the Middle East and Africa. Sanctions will also add to a growing concern of inflation. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of the EU's oil imports and 40% of the EU's gas imports. The world energy market and commodities have been affected and will continue to witness price surges, especially when it comes to oil. On Thursday, oil prices briefly topped $100 for the first time since 2014. The U.S. and several of its allies, including the European Union and the United Kingdom, have vowed to impose further restrictions on Moscow as punishment. In total, the sanctions will keep approximately $1 trillion in Russian banking assets from flowing through the markets of the U.S. and its partners' financial systems. The sanctions also limit tech exports to Russia and squeeze the country's tech industry. Those sanctions are the main foreign policy tool of Americans. The effectiveness of this tactic is debated. The sanctions already announced are significant in size and scope, but the long-time American reliance on sanctions has left the U.S. with few other options if Russia does not respond. Experts say Russia's sanctions are a big deal, but it could take quite a while, even years, for the sanctions to hurt the Russian economy.
They think they can destroy Russia and China by cutting them off. They cannot. It's a false dream. And it, unfortunately, if they continue, it probably will lead to war, perhaps nuclear war, and the annihilation of the human race.
Russian officials dismiss Western sanctions as ineffective. Russia's GDP has grown yet at a slow rate since the West imposed financial sanctions on Russia in 2014. The country's officials also point to low inflation, the minimal budget deficit, a public debt of only 18% of GDP at the end of 2020, steady current account surpluses, and international currency reserves of $596 billion at the end of 2020. Russians have got used to sanctions and therefore adapted their economy to them.
Almost 2 years after African-American George Floyd died beneath the knee of a white police officer on a street in Minneapolis, the police officers involved are being brought to account. A federal jury has found three former officers present at the scene of Floyd's arrest guilty of depriving the man of his civil rights. The jury found the conduct of the three officers led to Floyd's death, a charge that would impact the final verdict the officers will face. The three are convicted of failing to stop Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes, and denying Floyd's constitutional right to medical care while in custody. Tu Tao, Alexander Quang, and Thomas Lane will remain free on bail until their hearings, which aren't scheduled yet. What's for certain is that they'll face several years in prison. Chauvin, the officer arresting Floyd, was sentenced to 22 and a half years last year. For Floyd's family, it's not enough.
This is just accountability. It can never be justice because I can never get George back. And no matter how many times that I pray at night and I think about my brother 24/7, it still is going to be hard, even though we just had a federal conviction and we already had the state conviction. But times, you know, will be probably a lot harder for me still because I can't get my brother back.
The trials are considered historic in the U.S., where officers are hardly ever indicted for the treatment of the members of the black community. Racism in the United States dates back as long as its history. African Americans have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of white slave owners over the years, and the impact it made on American society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865, but the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
So I guess the main root is, you know, this country has been founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality with a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor, we can feed off of their work, we can feed off of their their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African-American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge?
You know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the rich interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention, as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often, and those administrations are subject to changing their positions from the last administration, then you find that Iran doesn't have any solid guarantees.
Iran says America's maximum pressure campaign has failed, and its credibility has been seriously deterred. Observers believe Washington now has to take measures to compensate for its past mistakes and regain the trust of the international community.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
If Tabriz had not made that great move on February 18th, the tradition of holding 40-day commemorations and continuing the battle would not have started and become common for the Iranian nation. When the 40-day ceremony of the martyrs of Qom was commemorated in Tabriz on the initiative of the people there, it became a model. And various other cities in Yazd and Kerman and cities of Fars province and in various other areas, this movement started and it brought the people to the arena of revolutionary activities. And therefore, the presence of the people led to the victory of revolution. The victory of the revolution was due to the presence of the people in the arena and in the streets. This revolution was won neither by guns, nor by political games, nor by partisanship. It was won with the presence of the people. And the presence of the people was due to these movements, movements which started and were initiated in Tabriz. Therefore, all of us, including your dear people of Tabriz, should thank God that your move was blessed and led to the victory of the revolution.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, the February 18th Tabriz uprising is an event. Azerbaijan has gone through various events and throughout history from a few centuries ago onwards, as much as we can boldly say, from 3 or 4 centuries ago onwards, Azerbaijan has been a promoter of national unity and national resistance. In other words, Azerbaijan and Tabriz were a key point for the unity of the Iranian nation and an important center for training the Iranian people to withstand various incidents. This leads to great honors for this city and this province. Of course, the 29th of Bahman is a great honor for East Azerbaijan and Tabriz themselves. Another point which deserves mention is that one of the great advantages of Azerbaijan is that the flag of devotion to the Ahlul Bayt has always been in the hands of the Azerbaijan people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way
and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship, and the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time, but observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us, we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions.
At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saeed Pourreza, London.
He is
referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran, Salah al-Zawawi, has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his four decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981, and before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than seven decades. After four decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare, and when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they're happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain whether the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban took over. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. Students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's parliament is reviewing the details of the budget bill for the next fiscal year, starting on March 21st. The government's proposed budget stands at roughly $148 billion, some 4% higher than last year's approved budget. Lawmakers have earlier approved the generalities of the budget bill, and it's been a week now since the thorough examination of the bill kicked off in parliament's open sessions.
The government's cap on next year's budget is roughly $148 billion. Out of this figure, $60 billion is allocated for the general budget and $88 billion is earmarked for government spending. Parliament is making some revisions, especially in national development projects and infrastructure. We increased the allocated budget in these areas.
This time, the budget's examination process took longer due to the fact that lawmakers want to be as meticulous as possible while evaluating the income and spending in the country.
While Iran and the P4 Plus One are engaged in tough negotiations in Vienna over the revival of the 2015 deal, President Ebrahim Raisi says the budget bill seeks to promote a resistance economy that would not need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions.
Parliament says the budget bill